Okay, so yeah, my name is Nelson Sanchez. I'm a physician currently at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City, and I'm going to be presenting some of the research I did when I was a resident at NYU Medical Center. So how does this work? Okay. So as I said, I'm going to be talking about research I did on access to medical care and hormone usage among male to female transgenders in New York City. I have no personal financial relationships to disclose. So just some background information. The current standards of care for transgender persons recommends a psychological and medical evaluation prior to hormone treatment with continued medical supervision during hormone use by a physician experienced in caring for transgender patients. When I was collecting some background information on the topic, the data was very limited, but some of the highlights that I uncovered were that the care provided currently to transgender individuals looks poor. According to one national survey, only 30 to 40% of transgender individuals utilize any regular medical care. The prevalence of unsupervised hormone use has been reported to range from as low as 29 to as high as 63% within urban groups of male to female transgender persons. And according to one report, the US-based HIV prevention literature found an average HIV prevalence of about 28% among male to female transgenders, and that ranges from 16 to 68%. So why is access to care important? So it would seem pretty intuitive, but some of the potential benefits are access to clean, safe needles. You know, if an individual has HIV, obviously, a potential mode of transmission is sharing needles. So one of the potential benefits of having medical care access is access to safe, clean needles and reducing the rates of HIV transmission. Another potential benefit is appropriate hormone administration. What does that entail? Traditionally, according to the current standards of care, for male to females, it's usually the use of an estrogen hormone, plus or minus a progesterone hormone, typically one of each. At times, some people use more than one estrogen compound to facilitate transitioning, but there is a risk associated with that as well, so that's not necessarily supported. And another potential benefit, if you have access to both a general practitioner and a mental health professional, you're probably more likely to be satisfied with your transitioning process. If you don't, you're potentially less likely to be satisfied. If you don't have care, what are the potential risks? So it's just the flip side. The risk is needle sharing, potentially increasing the risk of HIV transmission. If you're inappropriately using hormones, the usage of estrogen increases your risk of thromboembolism, deep vein thrombosis, potentially throwing a clot to your lung. So these are things that we want to avoid. Other potential side effects include mood swings, depression, migraines. If you're taking testosterone supplements, potentially dyslipidemias, high cholesterol. So these are things we want to avoid. And again, inappropriate hormone administration, just taking multiple hormone combinations at the same time could potentially increase these risks of side effects. So what are the potential barriers to access to healthcare? So it's pretty typical. Cost, inability to identify transgender-friendly providers, transgender knowledgeable providers, and transgender individuals may have an increased likelihood of having other comorbidities like depression or substance abuse that may impede their access to quality care. So the purpose of this study was to evaluate potential barriers to care, the types of healthcare providers currently utilized, including general practitioners, endocrinologists, and or mental health professionals, and the sources and types of hormones utilized. The hypothesis was persons with access to providers would be more likely to report fewer barriers to care, report fewer high-risk behaviors, and report care that is provided in accordance with current standards of care. We recruited participants from three sites in New York City. These included Citywide Harm Reduction, HousingWorks, and the Transgender Project. Citywide is a harm reduction agency located in the Bronx that offers outreach and services to homeless and low-income drug users living with and at risk for HIV/AIDS. HousingWorks is a community-based, not-for-profit organization whose mission is to provide housing, healthcare advocacy, and supportive services to homeless New Yorkers living with HIV and AIDS. And both Citywide and HousingWorks have weekly transgender meetings, social support networking meetings on a weekly basis. The Transgender Project is an NIH-funded research project serving trans persons on their individual economic, social, and personal experiences, and that, I believe, is still ongoing. We conducted one-on-one interviews between March of 2007 and August 2007, and we basically recruited by posting flyers and going to the weekly meetings and just asking anyone if they would be interested in participating, and if so, they did so. We also offered them $10 compensation for their time, and we received received approval from the Institutional Review Boards at both NYU Medical Center and Montefiore Medical Center. We use Montefiore because it has an association with Citywide Harm Reduction. We interviewed a total of 104 participants in the Bronx and Manhattan, but subjects could have lived in any of the boroughs throughout New York City. So you can kind of follow through maybe with the tables I passed out. I didn't include them in the slides because it was too much, but we included 101 participants in the analysis. We excluded three because the demographic data suggested duplication, so we excluded those. I think the sample was pretty heterogeneous. It was similar to samples in other studies performed in cities such as San Francisco and Philadelphia. Just looking it over, the average age was about 37. Racially, it was pretty diverse. Over a third were Hispanic, about a quarter were African American, about 20% were white, and about 8% were Asian. The majority were economically disadvantaged. If you look at table one, that's kind of suggested in the ability to pay for daily living expenses, and about 40% were unable to do that. So I would say that that's economically disadvantaged. Those with health insurance, for the most part, used Medicaid, which is in New York City. Basically, the means to accessing Medicaid among transgender individuals is to change their gender identity on their driver's license. So that's the gateway for medical care access in New York City. And I think it varies from state to state. Surprisingly, the proportion of individuals lacking access to insurance was pretty low. About 80% of our participants had access to a regular primary care provider, whereas in San Francisco, there was one report where it was to be found as high as 52% lacking medical insurance. And that's surprising because according to Medi-Cal, transgender individuals have access to regular primary care providers and hormone therapies. So that was a little surprising. So if you look, that goes along with table one. So one of the surprising things was that a high percentage of our sample had current access to a regular primary care provider. 81% had a current general practitioner. About half had access to a current mental health care provider. And only 6% had access to a specialist in hormone therapies, which was, you know, I guess it's subjective, but I think we would like it to be higher. If you look at table two, you can see how people responded in terms of barriers to care. Intuitively, an obvious barrier to care is cost of insurance and medical care. One thing that was not recorded was lack of citizenship, an obstacle to care. But just reviewing the data, obviously, if they were foreign born, if you go back to table one, those that were foreign born did not have regular access to a primary care provider. Another thing self-reported was inability to access a specialist and inability to access a transgender-friendly provider and trans-knowledgeable provider. And then just flipping to table three. Table three and table four, some of the benefits of access to care included those with access to a regular medical provider were more likely to receive a medical evaluation prior to starting hormone therapy. Those that had a medical provider were less likely to be active smokers, which is a high-risk behavior, which obviously we want to reduce. Those with access to medical providers were less likely to obtain needles or syringes from non-traditional sources. So those with access to providers were likely to go to a needle exchange program or to receive a prescription from a medical doctor. And those in addition with benefits with access to care were more likely to use hormones in line with traditional guidelines. Surprisingly, there was no benefit with access to care in terms of the usage of hormones from multiple and non-traditional sources. So, for example, despite having a doctor, individuals would still get extra hormones from their friends or off the black market. So they would supplement their prescribed medical therapy with off-label therapy, which is something that we would want to restrict. So, overall, in terms of our hypothesis, some things bore fruit and some things ran contrary. So as we suspected, people with access to regular providers were more likely to report fewer barriers to care, and they reported fewer high-risk behaviors, such as accessing safe needles and not smoking. But we didn't find that access to medical doctors necessarily correlated with traditional hormone therapy. So what do we do about that? So some ideas are, one, to continue to support transgender individuals' access to insurance and providers that are knowledgeable about transgender health concerns. We need to train future providers about transgender health concerns. So when they meet patients, they're able to meet their needs appropriately. And for the providers that are currently providing care, we should supplement their knowledge and keep them abreast of current treatment guidelines so they can carry those through. And the references, and you can read more about this. The research that I did was accepted for publication in August, and it should come out in the spring of 2009, so you can read more about it there. Thank you.